Thanks. So I'd like to start by thanking the organizers. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be able to speak to you here. So I've given this sort of review talk a few times, and most recently at Strings. And I'm actually more optimistic about this subject than I was then. I think there's been a variety of good progress. I won't start from ground zero. I'll assume you know something about this, because it's getting on. It's not quite a 20-year-old puzzle, but it's getting on. And I honestly think that just in terms of the study of quantum field theory, this is the outstanding question, open question in the subject, in the sense that certainly when I was a grad student, we all learned that there are no interacting unitary quantum field theories in more than four dimensions. And it's still very shocking to find that there are, and we really would like to know why. What is the principle that makes this work? It obviously has many applications. One comment is that we also learned that you can't formulate a renormalizable. I think it's on. At least I can hear something. Is the microphone on? No, I hear my voice speaking. Okay, now it's louder. So anyways, we also learned that you can't formulate a field theory of quantum gravity in more than two dimensions. And that's a central part of the reason why we believe in string theory. And of course, if the critical dimension were to be raised to there, that would be a very important thing to know. So we'd like to know how this theory can exist at all. Then, of course, there would be many applications. Okay, so again, I'm just going to very quickly run through these basics that we all learn as part of string theory. So we have, the simplest definition of the thing is we have M theory, we have N coincident M5 brains. We can write an action for a single M5 brain, and its world volume massless fields are this self-dual tensor multiplet of maximum chiral supersymmetry in six dimensions, 2, 0. And then we bring these things together, and we get some analog of the enhanced gauge symmetry that we understand in the case of D brains, but we don't understand it here. And then there are all these other observations that we're familiar with. We use them a lot in our arguments. We can get it by compactifying appropriate theory on a singularity. We have a large N dual. We can explain S-duality in four dimensions in this geometric way. We now can talk about all sorts of other compactifications through realization that you can twist and consider non-unitary interesting versions of the theory and have all sorts of applications to understanding lower dimensional theories. So it's a useful thing, and we don't have any real formulation that we can even make hand-waving arguments beyond the things we were just saying. And it's not for want of trying. So the first observation in the original papers of Witten and others was that we know, and I'll say a bit more, about the M2 stretch between the M5. This leads to a self-dual string charged under these self-dual gauge fields. When we compactify on T2, this leads to the W bosons and monopoles. Now, we can imagine, and it's certainly very plausible, that the point of symmetry restoration with the brains sitting on top of each other is the simplest point. And so then we'd like to understand tensionless strings. Okay, there is, of course, the matrix theory definition, which was where many of the other early facts about this system were derived. If you're going to compactify, general practice is that you compactify the least possible to get the job done and preserve the most symmetry. And so that favors looking at the compactification on T2. And you'd be even happier to look at the compactification on S1 if you can understand five-dimensional super Yang mills. And of course, I'll come to that topic. Okay, there's this argument called deconstruction that basically latticizes the fifth dimension and puts us in a quiver, an AN quiver of four-dimensional theories, which is a valid observation, but one that's, I talked a bit about it, strings, not clear how to actually use it as a formulation. There's, I think, the most straightforward approach that we're now, I think, getting to the point of being able to do is just to roll up our sleeves and try to actually do the conformal bootstrap, really say things about the conformal bootstrap in the way that's been very successful in four dimensions. A recent project I'm told is going to appear soon, it's kind of interesting, is a variation on all this that formulates the theory on, the six-dimensional theory on ADS space, or ADS 5 cross S1, and then that's something which hasn't been done before and leads to interesting relations. Okay, there's, as I said, been a number of, very interesting recent results, and in particular, there are calculations that reproduce this famous n-cubed scaling of the free energy that comes out of the gauge gravity duality, and I'll talk a bit about that. And I'll also talk about less well-explored ideas, which are speculative, but I think deserve more exploration. Okay, so again, to go through this kind of basic review and see if we agree. Okay, well, we all believe that it actually is a field theory, and this is not to be taken for granted. There are things like the six-dimensional little string theories that we believe are not field theories in the sense that there's not a local stress tensor, we don't have the usual constraints on correlation functions and the like. And of course, not having a formulation, we can't prove that. There are various arguments that lead us to believe it. Okay, it has no dimensionless parameters, has no relevant operators that actually preserve 2-0. You can break to 1-0 or do other things, but it's a unique class of theories in this sense. Moduli space is just like five-dimensional super Yang mills, and so you can go off to a broken phase, a totally broken phase, in which the theory at least has a known sensible low energy limit, product of Abelian theories. And then I'm going to say a bit about this point that I emphasized at strings as well, that they're really, you're very tempted to say the theory must involve extended objects in some way. But I'll try to, I won't get very far, but at least I'll try to say what that might mean. Okay, so one point, familiar, but to keep clearly in mind, is that the observables are very different, the ones that you think you can look at in the Coulomb in the unbroken phase. And this is familiar from N equals 4 super Yang mills, that people do these calculations in perturbation theory, but it's actually quite subtle to say what you mean about the S matrix of N equals 4 super Yang mills for the same reasons as in four-dimensional pure Yang mills and QCD and the like. And so we are relying on the the labors of people that try to understand this for real world applications in at least some of our thinking about super Yang mills at the unbroken point there. And we certainly do not understand that for 2-0. And so we really don't know whether the unbroken phase has a sensible definition of S matrix. Maybe it'd be a very interesting question to work on. Coulomb phase, I don't see how it couldn't have an S matrix. You can certainly scatter these Abelian things, you can scatter massive charged particles and so forth. It has this rich spectrum of charged BPS states. There are, I won't say anything real about these Wilson surfaces for the unbroken phase, but this, again, we haven't really exploited or understood this parallel, which in some of what we know, like the gauge gravity duality, the six and four dimensional and three dimensional are very parallel. And so a lot of directions haven't been explored. Okay, this is, again, some words about this question of what does it actually mean to say that the theory has extended objects or is formulated in terms of extended objects. And I don't think it's a very clear concept. And in fact, the fact that we are talking about a conformal field theory in the unbroken phase, we can certainly use the usual state operator correspondence and create all states using local operators. And so you might be tempted to say, oh, there's no need to talk about extended objects, and I would have a hard time refuting that. But still, there are this long-standing intuition and at least a few results that say that how do you ever get an interacting field theory in more than four dimensions? Well, the cases where we know anything about interacting quantum field theories in more than four dimensions, there's an extended object. There's a string or just some sort of more mysterious membrane or matrix thing or whatever. And so it is a very tempting intuition. Now, we probably haven't explored all the possibilities. It might even be some other kind of extended thing, which we would want to make the field depend on to properly formulate this theory. But, well, who knows? Well, okay. So, as I said, if I wish I understood this slide. It's not like this is more meant to be provocative. But we have this class of theories that we do know how to formulate well in field theory. We have this class like string field theory where it's not like we understand it very well, but we can write down operators and we can do some calculations with it, and it seems to make sense. And the basic definition of theory is in terms of a field which is a functional of something. And then it's, again, hard to, I think it's possible, but it's hard to make precise exactly what that something is, because you can always expand it out. You can always expand a string field and say, it's a sum of an infinite number of point fields. So what's the difference, once you allow infinite numbers of things? And it's, one could give a whole talk on that. But intuitively, it's very useful to know that it's describing a string. And there may be some equally useful intuition that we're missing. So I know I did not answer your question, and I'm just trying to throw this out as a thing we're thinking about. Okay, so I think, on the one hand, there is this kind of intuition that the interacting theories in more than four dimensions probably are so because they have extended objects. On the other hand, this is the more or less, the almost unique case of, conformal theory in higher dimensions, presumably with extended objects. So an extended object with no preferred size. And so that's a strange thing, and people recognize this from the beginning. In particular, most formulations involve what we'll call instantonic particles, and I'll be more precise if you haven't seen that. But in any case, you have a soliton with collective coordinates, such as a zero mode, but it's got a scale size. And if you talked about a tensorless string, you would have a similar thing. You got the string, it's got a size, could be big, could be small. And because you're defining a conformal field theory, there cannot be any preferred value of that size. And so be it. But it's very hard to understand quite how such objects can sit in stationary states. It's, again, not impossible. You have a wave function that falls off of exactly the right power law, to make it normalizable. In the case at hand, we're going to find we don't understand that for reasons that were well known from the beginning. There are zero size limits of that moduli space. So I'm throwing out these points that reflection has convinced me are central aspects of the problem without being able to say anything very useful about them, but that's my privilege as the overview speaker. Okay, so now 2-0 supersymmetry algebra can be found in many references, and this tells us the BPS spectrum if we work it out, and so we can verify some of these basic statements that I alluded to, such as the existence of the self-dual string, the tension of the self-dual string, the relation between these objects and the analogs after we compactify. This is the statement that wrapped self-dual strings about an A and B cycle turn into the W bosons and monopoles of N equals 4 theory in particular. Okay, so again, it's not crazy to say that theory at the unbroken point might be formulated in terms of tensionless strings. The problem in practice that people, again, this is one of these old problems, and had other, been studied for more than one reason. In particular, it might be an interesting limit of fundamental string theory in which you can neglect the string tension. And so there are references that carefully try to find actions and quantize them. And the basic result is that they fail. So people do get things to work in two dimensions, but nobody's had any success, and the field has this kind of bad reputation. Although, again, if you could prove there was nothing, that would be a result. And so we don't know, but certainly no progress on D equals 6 has been made that way. Of course, there's the standard problem that string theories tend not to have local correlation functions anyways, but again, that turned out to be solvable for a QCD string. You know, maybe we haven't had the right idea here. Okay, and again, I'll repeat this point that at least it's got an extended object, but then the size of the extended object and what is actually setting it. You know, either it's a string that has some sort of a scale invariant wave function, you know, so it's, you know, big and small, has both components, or it's necessarily dynamical. You know, there is no stationary state of the thing. It's growing, it's shrinking. Our usual intuitions about string theory are going to have to change for it. Okay, so anyways, we turn away from that, and now we start looking at the compactification on S1 down to 5 dimensions. And because we started with a self-dual tensor, we have the right number of components to directly reduce to a ordinary vector boson and vector multiplet in 5 dimensions. And then, of course, there are very good arguments to say that, well, now the non-abelian completion of that theory is the standard one. It's just 5-dimensional super Yang-Mills. Okay, so then what would be the relation between the original 2-0 theory and that? And the first step is to recognize that the Kaluza-Klein momentum, well, it was one of those central charges on the previous slide, and so it must have some topological or, you know, central chargey origin in 5 dimensions. And again, it's a standard thing to check that it's the instanton charge. So we're in 5 dimensions. The self-dual solution of Yang-Mills theory is 4-dimensional, and if we just take one of those to sit at a point and extend in time, we get a particle, and that is the instantonic particle, and you can easily check that it carries this 5-dimensional central charge, which would have been the Kaluza-Klein 6 momentum in the 2-0 theory. It's quantized, that's good. You know, so we see that the 5-dimensional theory definitely knows that there was this 6th dimension and that it's compact. Okay, so that's good. And then, of course, you know, I'm sure you could, you know, if a mathematician, you could come up with the proof. I'm just going to say the one instanton sector really has to be that minimal Kaluza-Klein momentum. And then we know the mass of this instantonic particle. So we get a direct linear relation between the 5-dimensional radius and the square of this 5-dimensional Yang-Mills coupling, which already on power counting grounds, which should have dimensions of length. So that's a central relation in the theory. And of course, so the relations are sort of a, you know, weak, strong duality in the sense that R5 becomes big and we're 6-dimensional when we're strongly coupled, although that's a little misleading because it's a dimensionful coupling constant, and the real physical thing would be to look at energy measured in these units, or, you know, G squared energy, and high energy processes would be strongly coupled. Okay, so the particle, the instantonic particle, is half BPS, and that is what you expect, and it fills out the Kaluza-Klein modicity self-dual tensor multiplets. And Lambert et al. Particularly, and others, have looked carefully at the spectrum in the Coulomb branch. Okay, so in particular, there's a dionic instanton, which is the natural analog of this thing. It's an explicit solution, which is different in some ways. In particular, it's a quarter BPS. And you could have asked, I think, from the evidence they gave, whether this spectrum of these particles actually did match up with 2-0 theory, because it's a more complicated multiple structure. But there's some indirect evidence, but I certainly believe this from the fact that there are various localization calculations that were done since, and I'll talk a little bit about this later, that take various different starting points, not just a single 5-dimensional, say, you know, 5-dimensional gauge 3 on S5 cross S1, but various starting points and find a consistent superconformal index. And if somehow this point were messing up, this, I don't think, could work.
So you get just by
Well, no, we have to be more precise. I'm getting to the sense in which this is an effective theory coming from six dimensions. Okay, so then what's the other thing? Well, the wound self-dual strings were these W boson and monopole, and of course there are unwound self-dual strings as well, and the equals 5 theory also has a candidate which does have the right central charge to be those, and it's just the five-dimensional analog of the Tuff-Polyakov monopole, and it's also got the right relation to the scalars, and it, you know, has that central charge, so that has to be right. Okay, so the basic states that you would expect, and certainly these have, and you know, it looks like we're in the Coulomb phase BPS states, are there. And you know, there's, again, a variety of literature checking more complicated states of this sort. And so now we have the kind of, I don't know, unique, but I tend to think, you know, unique case of a theory where, on the one hand, you know, everything we know would say that, well, this is just an effective theory. You know, we threw away extra degrees of freedom. We know this is non-normalizable. So, you know, we're going to have to cut it off and somehow get the extra states have to come in at that energy scale, and I'll say a little more later. You know, but on the other hand, what are the extra states? Because we've already accounted for all this, all the interesting states, all the BPS states. You know, when is a theory ever cut off by a non-BPS state? Well, you know, those are theories that we know nothing about. So it's possible that that's why we don't know, but I address that point in my strings talk, and I don't believe it. So, okay. So we seem to have all the BPS states. On the other hand, theory does have UV divergence at six loops, so it's really not a complete theory in its own. It's an effective theory up to some scale lambda. And there can't be another scale. Again, this is an argument that I belabored in the strings talk. If there were two fundamental scales, it would be a dimensionless parameter. And the 2-0 theory would inherit it. Okay. Mostly, I'm talking about the Coulomb phase. You know, certainly all these BPS states were much easier to talk about in the Coulomb phase. So that's my basic answer. I mean, obviously, if we've come up with a good microscopic formulation, it should work both ways. And for these UV questions, we should be able to work in either the broken or unbroken phase in the usual way. But again, when I talk about states, I'm generally in the Coulomb phase. Okay. Okay, so it's a pretty confusing situation, but you know, again, it's very, very plausible that if the BPS spectrum we see is, you know, what cuts off the theory, it has to be these instantonic particles. And you know, again, in the strings talk, I talked about the role of the strings, and now you can see, well, the self-dual string, you know, really doesn't have the properties it would need to do this. And so now one's led to the hypothesis, because it's not quite precise enough to be a conjecture, that if you could somehow include the quantum effects of these instantonic particles, you would cut off the six-loop divergence and presumably all the divergences and get a complete formulation. Yes? Well, I think there's a lot of differences, you know. I mean, obviously the most salient one is that we know the better microscopic definition, and you know, we could certainly try to prescribe other degrees of freedom that are more appropriate to the UV of the equals six. And none of this I'm saying that you could not also have such a description. Okay, so that's the first comment. And well, if you could come up with a example like this with the same kind of a BPS argument that said that you know, we control the masses of the states, you know, the skirmion is BPS, you know, and we know there aren't any other BPS states, then I think your objection would have some force. I mean, no. I'm not saying that the five-dimensional Super Yang-Mills action is exact. I'm saying that there are physical states that, you know, first of all, that we can, you know, think about in something like the way we do in perturbation theory. They include these various particles. So another difference, again, Nadi, is that to make a better analogy, I think you would want to come up with a case where the spectrum of mesons that you see at low energy, they're BPS, and you have the same BPS objects at high energy, you know, again, because you can really match up the objects in five and six dimensions in a much simpler way than the matching of confinement that confinement gives you in the, you know, skirmion QCD analogy. Yeah, I'll get to that. I'll get to a more concrete conjecture, yeah. Okay, so I mean, what would we want to do to check this? We would want to first grant that there's something you can do with perturbation theory. I mean, that's certainly the simplest thing to try first. And try to put the interstellar particles into the loops. And then you need something. Well, obviously, you'd like to calculate and see if the theory is finite, but you also would like other things to check. And the theory that we know the most about is certainly not five-dimensional Yang-Mills. It's what we get by further compactification down to a four-dimensional Yang-Mills. And so I think the most interesting version of the question, and I'm going to get to it. I think I'm going to get to it. So I was asked, to what extent is this five-dimensional action, you know, exact? You know, are there higher derivative terms and so forth? And the answer, I think the answer has to be, if this makes sense, that there are higher derivative terms, but they are effective terms that you get by integrating out things like these particles. Okay, so I'll describe a calculation. Well, it's the same calculation I described the strings as an example of that. Anyways, a simpler or an equally good test of this claim is that if things are really just perturbation theory with these extra states stuck in, where does the n cubed of the free energy come from? You know, since there don't seem to be n cubed states in there. Okay, and certainly there were various places that possible n cubed numbers of states could come in, all complicated to analyze, but there does seem to have been progress on that, and this came through localization calculations of the sort that Nikita Nekrasov pioneered. And so the n to the 3 halves behavior of the free energy of the three-dimensional ABGM theory was reproduced from localization calculations not so long ago. And very recently, it's been claimed by Jolene, Minahan, Nadella, and Zabzin that they can reproduce the n cubed with the right coefficient. Okay, and it's a subtle argument. I'm not going to say that I know it's correct, because in particular, Euclidean continuation is somewhat ambiguous. The theory, the 2-0 theory, doesn't really exist in Euclidean space. But you can invite them to speak about it themselves. Okay, so anyways, localization techniques are very powerful and reduce certain gauge theory calculations to matrix models. Again, deserves a talk of its own. And one can get, in particular, this free energy. And it turns out that it goes as n squared. It's a matrix model. It's the planar leading term. It goes as n squared. So how can this reproduce the non-four-dimensional cases? Well, it really seems like it's just a matter of being careful about the matching, because the difference is that whereas we had this interesting function that went from, you know, 3/4 to 1, you know, it's always a function of lambda here, but it was, you know, constant asymptotics and strongly recoupling. Here, it's a non-constant power-like asymptotic at strong coupling. It's lambda to the -1/2 from the three-dimensional calculation I saw it. And then you match and you find that, well, it's right that supergravity has one explanation, you know, one place where you match the Jangles coupling, another one where you match n. So this lambda to minus 1/2 with the n inserted really combines with that. And you know, it almost seems like cheating, but there it is. And it is a correct calculation given this localization and a correct matching. And so now you can see that if these are the rules of the game, it's actually much easier to get the six-dimensional answer than you thought, because all you need is lambda to be the strong coupling limit. And lambda is not even that hard a term to see, because if you had a two-loop contribution, that would go as lambda. And then, although you would not trust a simple two-loop result as being valid to the strong coupling, you can get this localization result to, you know, as an exact function. In perturbation, you know, recoupling, you can see it really does come from two-loop diagrams. But then that term is also the one that controls the strong coupling limit. So it's, and then where did the G squared come from? Well, that's R5, and the six-dimensional free energy had to somehow get at that R5 if you were reconstructing it from five dimensions. So there it is. And it's one of these puzzles that the answer is kind of so shockingly simple, you know, that you know, it's sort of embarrassing. But you know, if they're right, then they're right. Okay, so there's a lot of hidden knowledge about the theory going into this, to claim that, you know, we believe these calculations as strong coupling. There's I mentioned it again, those who have looked at this at all know that there's treatment of the zero size, you know, the various singularities of instant time moduli space always shows up in trying to make any precise statements from five-dimensional, from any gauge theory, of course, but in the case at hand, you need them to get this to work, and there are such statements made. There were questions, you may recall it, strings for the speakers, and they are there in the papers. Yes? No, I'm saying it's not at all. I mean, it's a non-trivial function. I didn't say f of lambda is lambda, but that is a leading term in strong coupling. And, you know, again, I'm kind of, I don't want to put words in the mouths of the author, but they certainly say it's very interesting that you can see the two loop. You can see that it's the same leading term as strong coupling. Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. Yeah, it's very easy to get n cubed out of a two-loop diagram, as you know. I think the C. We can go back and check, you know, what they say. I mean, the C is tricky. That's the thing. You see, the only people that claim to get the C are Minahan and his collaborators. And there's this story about the Euclidean continuation that the C depends on. So it may be a little premature to really answer your question. Okay. So that certainly seems like an important result to me. And for somebody that says that we can learn something by applying perturbation theory in five dimensions, it's rather encouraging. And so we continue. And in the, you know, paper I wrote, what was it, you know, 3 years ago, I looked at this reduction down to four dimensions. And again, these are points I made in my strings talk, but it's, I think, a point that's worth making, is that the naive way to do dimensional reduction, of course, is to throw away Kaluza-Klein states and all of the extra dimensional stuff. And you know, usually you get the right answer that way. And we know generally the cases where we don't. But of course, if a theory has UV divergences, you would have to be very careful about that, because clearly these high energy states that you're throwing away are going to contribute to the UV divergences. And we know D equals 5 superangles has UV divergences. And how do you get down to 4 without passing through 5? Well, you know, it seems like we should just not at all trust, you know, this, you know, an argument that says that you had a six-dimensional or a five-dimensional theory and you, you know, compactify it in the same way you just throw away those states. You have to know what the states do. Okay, so that's, you know, again, easy to say. You know, how do we know what the states do? That's the hard part. Oh yeah, but definitely those states could survive at low energies, and in particular, they could survive in, you know, couplings of controlling higher dimensional operators. And so we know, again, the leading, you know, two derivative P piece of the action from supersymmetry, but once you start looking at higher derivative, less protected or unprotected things, then it's a more interesting question. And what we're really looking at to understand this is not an equal source of Jungian metals. It's this theory that we get by compactifying from 6 to 4 on a small, you know, but finite size T2, and then that's giving us another scale that's controlling higher derivative corrections. It also gives us more states because there was the original unwrapped self-dual string. So you recall that when we went down to 5, we had a candidate to match with the unwrapped self-dual string. It was this monopole string. But then if you go down to 4, you know, there isn't a string. There is not a charged string in four-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. But fortunately, when you look at the scaling, and that was on a previous slide, but it's an exercise, you find that the scaling that takes this torus to 0 scales the tension of that self-dual, that remaining unwound string, off to infinity. So it goes away from any sort of super Yang-Mills, but it's here in this extended super Yang-Mills. So that's the theory, which is sort of the target of trying to define the 5 in the 6-dimensional theory point of view, and you'd like to see what you can understand about it. And the one thing that, again, I would claim that I had some understanding, but this is, again, something I spoke about as strings, is the coefficient of the trace f to the 4 term in the effective action of this theory. So that coefficient goes as the volume of the 2 torus squared. That gives a scale. There's some calculable number sitting in front of it. And then this is the best case because we knew that this was a protected quantity. It should only get contributions of one loop. And so now you can try to compute it from 5-dimensional reduced down to 4 dimensions. It's an easy calculation. It gives a sensible-looking answer, except that it's not S-dual, because you only took the 5-dimensional occlusive Klein states. You didn't take the 6-dimensional occlusive Klein states. But of course, that's an easy problem to fix. You can just put in the other states and just impose S-duality by fiat. And this still hasn't been checked, but I would be quite surprised if this were not right. Yeah. That's right. This is trace f to the 4 in this effective 4-dimensional action. It comes from a loop of Kaluza-Klein states, and similarly, there would be a loop of S1 Kaluza-Klein states that you could try to think about in 5 dimensions, which you would not have any constraint like this. You would get basically the same number here, and I wouldn't know what else to say about it. Pretty much. I mean, there's a different power here, so it could be like zeta of 5 or something. I don't think anything is known about these higher dimensional trends. I can't recall any papers. Yeah. So that's another prediction, I guess. Again, I think that, you get a different power here, but you can work out the prediction. Okay. So anyways, one can try to build on that success, although, again, the fact that that was a protected amplitude, may make one, less optimistic about the non-protected amplitudes. But certainly you can, in principle, write down loop diagrams to any order. We even know how to write down the 6 loop. So you can then go from 5 to 4 and then try to S-dualize this sum over the Kaluza-Klein states. And you need to know more, So, you didn't need to know anything to do the S-dualization I described. And rather than do it by pure mathematical guesswork, you'd actually like to know something about the couplings to the six-dimensional states. And I'll get to, that's leading to the point that you'd like to have something more like an action to work from. But from this kind of heuristic point of view, just, does anything work? The principle is that S-duality is in 4 dimensions, is a pretty strong constraint. And so you do know a lot about those couplings. Also, you could, in principle, try to compute them from the 5-dimensional microscopic definition of these instantonic particles. And so one point which Papadrugakis and Royston have looked at is that unlike solitons in the usual, they have scales where you have a form factor that would exponentially suppress their couplings at high energies. Here, you will not get exponential suppression basically because the scale size can run down to zero. So there's no, again, immediate contradiction with claiming that the solitons can play the role that we would be asking them to play in cutting off loop divergences. Okay, so anyways, it's a subtle business if one tries to think about doing these computations. And I think, again, this I'm not going to really go through this, but the talk will be on the web. You know, it really does bear some thought. And so anyways, the test of this would be to, you know, come up with a S-dualized Ansatz for the two-loop amplitude, an S-dualized Ansatz for the three-loop amplitude, and now D squared F to the 4. You know, trace D squared F to the 4 is this next unprotected term that can get contributions where you could get a divergence in the field theory calculation. Now you've got more states running around loops. So this guy should even diverge at three loops, like a six-dimensional calculation. But maybe if we put these states in and get these couplings right, these new states will cancel the divergences. And so, as I promised, there is a more concrete form of the hypothesis, not totally concrete at this point, because I didn't tell you those couplings, but I did tell you that we know quite a bit about them. Okay, so again, there's an example of this in the published, you know, paper from 3 years ago, but you expand the six-dimensional, you know, heuristically. I mean, it started off as a five-dimensional field, but let's think of it as a six-dimensional field in the five- and six-dimension Kaluza-Klein modes. And now you've written the loop diagrams as an infinite sum. You're still in R4, so every term in that sum is actually a standard four-dimensional n equals four super Yang Mills amplitude, but you've just said that certain lines in my diagram have these various P4 and P5, which give them a mass. But then they're pretty conventional, massive Yang Mills multiplets, so you can use conventional D equals 4 technology to compute any such amplitude, and then sum it up. And the UV behavior is the same. You just turn the integral into a sum. And a priori, this will diverge at three loops. OK, so I don't know. I mean, yeah, not from an infinite sum. That's right. And so it is regulated in some sense. You know, you could, I mean, you might have to think about what it means, how you sum it. But by making sense, you mean finite or infinite? Or by making sense, you mean? Well, I mean, what are we comparing with? Again, it has six-dimensional power counting. I mean, but I'm not quite, I mean, maybe we can talk later if you have an idea. But I think you could step back from this, and the very reasonable remark is to say, well, you know, let's be very optimistic and suppose this all works. You know, three loops, good, you know, but, you know, infinite, all loop orders, you know, there must be some principle that's making it work. And so why don't we just try to find that principle rather than go to all this guesswork? And, you know, it's almost certain that the principle would be some sort of a non-manifest supersymmetry involving the extra modes. And now you would say, well, you know, but now we're back in the where we started, you know, because people certainly started out with this project of looking for a supersymmetric six-dimensional action, and they failed. And not only did they fail, but there really are very simple no-go arguments. Even in Witten's early papers, one notices that, let's suppose we have this local six-dimensional Lagrangian, now we reduce it to five dimensions. Always, that leads to a multiplicative factor of the volume of the space, in this case, 2 pi r5 sitting in front of the reduced action. But of course, we don't want that. We want the r5 in the denominator. So that's certainly a major obstacle. But what it basically tells you is that if this exists at all, the L6 is not going to be local. Okay, and well, you know, so what good is it? Well, the idea is that, well, we're not even claiming that this L6 is the definition of the theory. The definition of the theory is five-dimensional super Yang Mills. We're just using it as a tool to summarize the couplings to these solitons and non-perturbative states, and there really isn't any reason it should be local. Okay, so, you know, again, assuming that, you know, things worked up to this point, I think that would be a very plausible thing to say. Okay, so, well, what about this six-dimensional action in this hypothetical supersymmetry? Well, this is, again, it's not an untrodden path, and people have started writing down non-local actions to try to solve this problem. You know, even the cubic coupling is not terribly obvious what it is. I'm not going to try to survey this topic. I've just given a few references, but the maybe illustration that I'll give is a action written down not too long ago by Chu and Co. Okay, and here's the reference. And there's, again, quite a few, modest number of papers along this general topic. And then this is just a bosonic action, but it does claim to be a non-abelian action of self-dual tensors. And well, how do you write any action of self-dual tensors? Well, there are many solutions to that. And the one they started with is the Perry-Schwarz action, which just abandons a six-dimensional manifest covariance. So we have a 5x5 anti-symmetric field B, and we basically write an action that's got various auxiliary fields, the most interesting one being one that, well, in this case, implements this sort of constraint. So you can basically solve, in the abelian case, it's easy to solve for the H and get back to the usual sort of action. Okay, so now what do Chu and Ho say? Well, again, many, many authors have felt that if there's anything at all simple enough to have any chance of working, well, we know how to implement our gauge symmetry. It has vector potentials. You know, there really is no other way to do it. So we put in a vector potential, but it's going to be an auxiliary field. And so now what is the auxiliary field? Well, now that it's become clear that the theory has to be non-local, there's a fairly simple candidate for the constraint that you want to determine the curvature of this auxiliary gauge field. It's proportional to the integral of that extra sixth dimension of various components of H. And then, again, they are able to do some things with it, you know, reproduce standard equations of motion that have these solitonic solutions that I described. An easy thing to see, but again, maybe worth making the point is that, well, it does solve this paradox. In fact, it's very easy to solve the paradox once you start having constraints like this, that R5 appears explicitly in the reduction, then you can easily get 1 over R5 when you solve for your auxiliary fields, and it solves that particular paradox. Okay, so I think I want to make sure I didn't skip anything concrete, because my remaining comments are just going to be comments about other directions. Again, it's not like we have an obvious good way to work on this problem, but as I said, I'm optimistic because I feel that we actually do start to know things, non-trivial new things about this theory, and so it's a good time to pick up this problem, and well within the purvey of this workshop. So one of the topics which seems to be pretty neglected in literature, and there are some papers by Gustafsson, but not too many, is, of course, there's this analogy between the d equals 4 and d equals 6, but in particular, there's a Wilson surface that we would know how to formulate in the abelian theory. We don't know how to formulate it in this six-dimensional theory. We can't be 100% sure it's there, but it's certainly there in this gravity dual. We can compute Wilson surface amplitudes in the gravity dual and, in principle, say quite a bit about them. And that would surely be valuable knowledge to have. Okay, and then the other direction, which seems like the straight line approach, would be the conformal bootstrap. And again, there's a lot of technology that would go into this, but this is certainly the approach that makes basically no assumptions besides this, local conformal field theory. And so it's certainly worth developing. And again, we have many of the ingredients that would go into it. So let me, again, recommend these problems to you and hope that we continue to make progress. So I'll stop there.
This is a very elementary question. So in four dimensions, let's say there's the n equals four super Young Mills, which is kind of unique and super conformal, and then there's all the ones with less supersymmetry or no supersymmetry. In six dimensions, is there just the 0, 2, or there?
No, definitely there's 0, 1. And there's, you know, varieties known, and there's actually recent work, I believe, of Heckman and Vaffa that to some extent classified the possible 0, 1 theories.
And no supersymmetry?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I mean, who knows? You know, I mean, this is six dimensions.
So suppose that you do bootstrap, and in 6D you find some information about non-protected operators.
Right.
This is something that we are very good at. Would it be possible to use this information to constrain somehow your idea about the actions, this 5D
well,
actions?
Well, I bet it would. We could talk about it. Even kind of the preliminaries of just setting up the formalism, I'm sure, would teach me quite a bit.
Yeah, I have a comment. The formalism has already been set up, and I think we can promise results before the end of the program.
Right.
It's Stakhanov approach.
Hey, just a comment about 1 over R5 in the coupling constant appearing from the dimensional reduction from 6 dimension to 5. When you do the dimensional reduction from, for example, R4 by compactifying on R3 cross S1 to S1 on, say, Coulomb branch associated with this Wilson line, then, of course, you would also expect L to be appearing in the numerator, but on the Coulomb branch, you can always dualize the photon to the scalar, and it comes out as 1 over L rather than L appearing there. Just seems to be similar, and again, you can relate it to some Bianchi ident type of.
Well, there is a close analogy, but again, I wanted, and again, I wasn't the first one to say this, to say that this is in six dimensions. This phenomenon is an obstacle to at least having a local action.
Oh, and, okay. It's local. So the relation between these two fields are local. Yours.
Yeah. So. So I think you make a good point that argument, you know, one should keep thinking about, but I this is what I think.
Would your conjecture then be the result would give zero?
No, I think, again, they definitely get a non-trivial function. I forget whether it even has a Taylor series. We can look it up. I am pretty sure that if I look at their answer, I would not be led to make that conjecture, but we can look at it. You're right, the summability of that function is quite important for these hopes.
I failed to see.
That's right, that's certainly the case where we are matching it. Yeah.
I think it's quite clear that there's no Lagrangian for this theory, and finding more arguments just beating that horse. But the situation is not that different than other examples. Say, in two dimensions, we have chiral bosons. And we know they exist, we can compute whatever we want them, and there's no nice Lorentz invariant Lagrangian for them. So I don't see why this
is
an argument.
Well, I wasn't even asking for a Lorentz invariant or nice Lagrangian.
But even non-Lorentz invariants, it's quite complex.
Well, again, the Lagrangian, as you see, I this was towards the end of the talk, it's really not what I would consider a central point. I got to the point of trying to motivate, you know, to want to use couplings to these extra six-dimensional states. And once you need to work with details of couplings, you know, Lagrangians are the way to summarize them.
Well, Lagrangian, for me, is a way of flowing from a free UV fixed point to an interacting one. And we don't expect that to be present here. In fact, even for the simplest one, which has only a one tensor multiplet, we can't write the Lagrangian. So how can we expect to write the Lagrangian for the one which is interacting? Even for the free one.
We've made the point, which I would agree, that I don't know any argument from, well, we know that 2-0 theory that the perturbative approach I described has to work. It might not work at all. The thing might not be summable. But then, again, I think one still learns by pressing these things a bit. And then there have been also many examples where one a priori didn't think a perturbative or a simple approach would work, and it had more validity than you thought. So I think it's, you know, not good to close off that direction. Well, I don't know. I think, again, this is one of these problems that has so much simpler solution, and there's just, you know, some particular idea we haven't thought of yet, you know. So I'm trying to expand the space of ideas that we look at.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank Mike again.